composers, from Carl Nielsen to Richard Rodney Bennett. So please do join James next Sunday, same time, 9 o'clock, here on BBC Radio 3. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this week by Neil Miners.
BBC Radio 3 pays tribute to a fascinating musician equally at home performing jazz as he was in the world of classical and film. Back in the year 2000, Richard Rodney Bennett and I performed together in an early edition of Jazz Lineup, and this weekend the programme pays tribute to him with excerpts from that collaboration and a performance of his Jazz Calendar Suite. Richard was an unforgettable and insightful interviewee, and I know he was thrilled with the performance the musicians delivered of this popular suite. That's tonight on Jazz Lineup at 11 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
That was Claire Martin, and this is BBC Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Poets often aspire to the condition of music, and musicians often aspire to the condition of poetry. Fiona Sampson straddles both those disciplines. She's a very successful poet. Her recent collection is Coles Hill, and she was a professional musician. How, Fiona, did you come to move between those two worlds?
I moved abruptly and with some tears and consequences. I think probably I should have been a writer from the outset, but I grew up in the English provinces, possibly at a time when to be a girl with no particular background rather disqualified you from the writing life. And then I had wonderful music teachers. I came from a family of musicians, and I had wonderful music teachers really from quite soon. So I felt very close to what I'd loosely call the real thing in music. And I loved it and longed for it. Possibly that loving and longing was really for poetry, but poetry wasn't available to me. So rather like sort of water following its course, I got as close as I could to myself, really.
And you went to the Royal Academy of Music and you studied the violin.
Yes. Yeah.
And you were a professional violinist.
Yes, yeah. For a short while I was. Mm. Well, you know what it's like for young musicians. You have to be precocious. So you start giving recitals, you start teaching and so on, you know, probably from the age of 16. And I had a great time at the Academy. I was one of the last going through Sidney Griller's quartet class. Both before and after the Academy, I was taught by the wonderful Fred Grinke, the kind of the grandfather of British violin playing, who's such a warm and generous soul. And I had a great time playing chamber music.
You played in the NYO?
I did. I played in NYO when I was...
They've just won the Queen's Medal for Music, which is nice. First time an organisation has got it.
And quite right too, I think, because they do fabulous work with outreach, as well as it being inordinately exciting when you're in NYO. I joined NYO when I was 13 and I was in for 3 years. But nothing artistically in my life will ever quite beat that first season being conducted by Boulez and the young Simon Rattle, who must have been, I don't know, 20, 21, making his first disc, and playing the Berg Violin Concerto with Itzhak Palm. I mean, astonishing stuff.
Let's start with a piece that I think excited you hugely about the possibilities of music.
Yes. For me, music starts with chamber music. It starts with family chamber music. It starts with a lighted room and it's dark outside and you're playing something. Then later, when I used to go to music courses and so on, it was always the extracurricular chamber music that was the real thing, the real heart of the experience. And the Mendelssohn Octet, of course, was something we always all wanted to play because it's rare that you get enough instrumentalists together. And so, of course, Paradox that you do play it quite often. And it's such a, well, it's such a young man's piece. You know, he was 16. And
very life-affirming.
Absolutely. And that whole opening out, it's a whole sense of opening out into gloriousness, which, of course, is what you think life is going to be like when you're 16 yourself.
Part of the first movement from Mendelssohn's Octet in E-flat major, opus 20, played by the Vienna Octet. I couldn't help seeing in my mind's eye, Fiona Sampson, players smiling at each other as they throw ideas around in a way that you can only really do in chamber music. It's more difficult to do that in an orchestra, isn't it?
Yes, chamber music, it's like nothing else, isn't it, really? It's like speaking at the same time, but not speaking over each other. I can't think of any other form of collaboration that's quite the same.
I suppose another musical analogy would be that in opera you can actually articulate different emotions simultaneously, and you can't do that in any other art form.
Yes, I suppose that's absolutely true. I think when I've been unable to avoid noticing that poetry is similar to music, the similarity has been about extension through time, that sense of making an arc of sound actually out loud when you're reading through space, through time. But there's not the verticality of texture of something. Well, I suppose the texture or the playing off of different lines of or chromaticism is where language has more than one meaning, or where either a word has more than one meaning or a phrase has more than one meaning. For example, you're telling something narrative, but it has emotional resonance. But it's certainly not the same as polyphony.
We share a love of Bartok, I'm happy to say. And I think he's probably one of the great composers for string instruments.
Mm.
It seems to me that his six quartets, which you may well have played, are probably the greatest since Beethoven.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, my problem really was picking which Bartok. There's so much Bartok I could have picked, and indeed it would have been Bartok 2, probably. I suppose partly that must have been the influence of listening to folk music, mustn't it? But he has a great sense of gutsiness, the gut in the string, even as the fiddle, in the concertos too, as well as the orchestral music. War horses that all fiddle players go through are, well, one or other of the Bartok Rhapsodies. And of course they're sort of kitschified, if you could say that of a great modernist composer, that kind of kitschified gypsy music. But they're a joy to play because there's a kind of attack into that kind of bounce of the string that you don't really get with many other composers.
And this music is also, as are the quartets very often, a wonderful reflection of Bartok's ability to conjure up an atmosphere, a mood, night music. He loved the sound of insects, didn't he?
Yes. There are some modernist composers that we call colourists, but Bartok was definitely a colourist too. When I was a child, I used to hear my mother, who's a violin teacher, practising, and you might say, no wonder I became a fiddle player. And one of the pieces she used to play was a little short piece by Bartok called Evening in the Village, which I think he also made an orchestral setting of it. And I remember going to the Bartok Museum in Budapest and being very moved to see that in the particular display of his notebooks that they had open, there he was collecting this tune. Well, in fact, there are two tunes in it. And being moved later on too, I go repeatedly to Eastern Europe and I go by train because it's slow travel, obviously, literally.
And you appreciate that you're going somewhere else as opposed to going on an aeroplane.
Yeah. Yes, an aeroplane is a bit of a TARDIS, isn't it? You arrive in the capital, you do your work and you come away again. Whereas a train introduces you to the country from which that capital arises and, of course, also the people because they get on and off the train. And the further east and south you go, the slower the trains are. So coming back, quite often it turns out that I'm coming back from Bucharest or from the Black Sea coast and I'm going through northern Transylvania, not the mountainous bit where all the Romanians put all the spars and so on, but further north and west than that, the rolling plains where the train goes round the edge of these small villages, the typical Austro-Hungarian village houses, single story with a hipped gable, and there are kids playing in the mud. And Evening in the Village was a Transylvanian tune. You know, it's a piece collected from Transylvania, which I think was then Hungarian.
And you've written in your latest collection a poem which has the same sense of atmosphere that we're going to hear in this Bartok music for strings, percussion and celesta, I think.
Well, it certainly has the same atmosphere as Evening in the Village, which I think of as further away and stiller. I think of the music for stringed instrument, percussion and celesta as much more immediate in a way, just because the instrumentation.
Yes, there are moments in it, aren't there? There's a glistening,
and the uncanny stuff of the tune, timpani and so on. Yes.
Let's hear the poems. This is from your latest collection.
Yes, and actually the village in question here is My Village Coleshill, but Evening in the Village. Something calls me repeatedly. Distant music, tintinnabulation of zinc bowls, cooees. Like a cat called back at dusk, I move through high grass towards that voice, as if it pushed me, as if it pulled me.
Thank you. a wonderfully precise composer. And actually, he had a very precise conductor there.
He did, didn't he? And listening to it there, I heard it much more as chamber music, oddly. I think the precision of those voices, and, you know, when things are thrown from part to part. Whereas when I first came across it in NYO, there was a great blaze of sound around me, and it felt much more orchestral.
The second movement from the Music for Strings, Percussion and Celesta by Bartok, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Pierre Boulez. What was it like working under him when you were in the NYO?
Oh, stunning. I think he was a huge permission giver for me because, you know, there was a certain amount of anti-intellectualism in the British arts. And Boulez is so blazingly bright, and yet he's also an artist. He was the first role model for me like that. And also, he was absolutely brilliant at reading the texture of a score. That's to say, being able to say, you know, the fourth horn is too loud there or something. In a sense, I think it comes back to what we were saying about what's univocal and what's multivarious. And you had the sense that he could understand, as it were, vertically at every moment what every part in the orchestra was doing. And I know that sounds like a truism and that's what all conductors should do. But in fact, very often, of course, making sense of a piece of music is with the big picture, thinking of it as one whole which passes possibly from voice to voice. Whereas with Boulez was a kind of vertical simultaneity. It was quite different from certainly from Simon Rattle, who'd just been working with us. Of course, he was brilliant in a different way.
Now, Fiona Sampson, you've had quite an important relationship with Slav music. And we're going to hear some folk music now, which is well appropriate because Bartok, as you were saying, took so much of his inspiration from folk music.
Yes, I've worked a lot in Central Europe and the Balkans. I have several books over there. I go repeatedly for conferences and festivals, and I used to edit a magazine called Orient Express, which was writing from all the post-communist countries of Europe. I'm very attracted to the culture because of its seriousness and kind of ambition for its art. And one of the things that happens when you go over there is that you discover the originals. That's to say that every festival ends up with people dancing the kolo, dancing the circle dance, not some stage version with some troupe in ethnic costume doing it, but the people themselves. And there's always a gypsy band brought in to play. And if you're staying in a hotel and people are having a party downstairs, they'll be dancing the kolo, they'll be dancing in seven time. And of course, it's an irony to come to that after the art music, but it's a pleasure to discover it.
So what have you chosen?
I've chosen Svetlana Spajic, who's singing Where Is My Little Goat? Where is it, my little goat? But I think folk songs have their own logic, don't they? Gde si bilo jare moje? Gde si bilo dušo more? Gde si bilo
Koji tebi je, jare moje, amigas d'amore, svi ciobani duša more, svi ciobani planinari. Kako plačeš, jare moje, kako plačeš, dušo more, kako plačeš, jare moje. Keker, beker, gazdo more, keker, beker, dušo more, keker, beker, gazdo more.
The unaccompanied human voice can be so beautiful. And there is there just a tinge of Moorish Arabic.
Oh, absolutely. It's not just a minor key, is it? And when you hear the instrumental pieces, their decoration is extremely Eastern.
It's in the decoration, in fact.
Yes, yes, it is, isn't it? I think, obviously, Svetlana Spajic is a professional singer. She's not some woman in a village. And one of the things that's happened in the Balkans is that the soundtrack for the terrible wars of the 90s was turbo folk, a kind of zhuzhed up use of folk tunes. And it was a mafia aesthetic, very blingy, very obvious. And Radio B92, who contributed to the defeat of nationalism by broadcasting Western rock music, which seems to me a complex thing, but anyway, they were very anti-nationalist in Belgrade, survived the war, and they released this CD and some others, going back to serious ethnomusicologists and serious performers of traditional music who were rejecting the turbofolk aesthetic. So this came out in 2000, and it was a very significant gesture in sort of within Serbian culture to sort of try and rid itself of the canker of violent nationalism.
But
without
actually,
shame.
You touch on something which has disturbed me in a rather different context quite often, which is where you get really beautiful ethnic music. I mean, in India, for example, or South Africa, wherever it is. And people start adding electric guitars and drums, and something is lost in that. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing because it brings it to a wider audience, as long as you don't lose the raw quality of the original.
I think the trouble is that people want to make a good living and they're prepared to sacrifice the thing itself for entertainment. And you're right, that entertainment might be bridge building, it might be many things, mightn't it? That reminds me of the way that people in Central Europe and Southeastern Europe are desperate to be translated into English. And they feel that then they'll have lots of readers and so on, which of course may not be true, because certainly poetry is not taken as seriously in the Anglophone world as it is in those cultures.
Because I don't think you found poetry a particularly happier world than the world of music, have you?
No. I think that poets thrive when they live in a culture that celebrates their work and gives them a role. And that's probably not particularly the case in Britain at the moment.
I think contemporary classical music comes quite close to that as well.
Yes.
And if you think about it, the contemporary composers who are really doing well are those that get closest to pop music.
Yes.
And I don't necessarily mean that in a pejorative sense.
No, I think that's true, and it's possibly true of poetry too. And probably that takes us back to the sort of Boulez role model, doesn't it? There remains, I think, on the European continent, a sense of certainly this hyphenated writer and intellectual identity, but a sense of all artists as, quotes, intellectuals. In other words, there remains a kind of shamelessness about seriousness and difficulty.
And avant-garde.
And avant-garde, mm. yes. Mm. And a sense that those things aren't somehow deliberate elitist obstacles. They're simply part of the working out of a complicated experience, which should be mirrored probably in artistic complexity. And I think there's a terrible misunderstanding in one strand of British thinking about the arts, which has quite a patronising view, actually, of people and what they can digest. I've spent a lot of time working in community residences. I had the sense that, it's like the Kodai method, you're going out and so on. And what I found was that people really in quite disadvantaged situations, people who probably don't have great literacy, who certainly don't see themselves as readers of poetry, are moved by, they can tell the real thing. And they are bored by the kind of meretricious, as it were, poetry light that they're often fed. And I think it's elitist to withhold good stuff from people.
Let's go back now to music that you got great pleasure from playing, and undisputed masterpiece.
Yes, unaccompanied Bach. I mean, for me, actually, unaccompanied Bach means Menuhin, that tremendous kind of breathiness and sense of profound thought going on. But actually, the E major partita, which I used to play all the time, oddly doesn't survive that. Certainly the prelude doesn't, because it needs to be vibrant and ringing. So I think you've got Nathan Milstein playing, haven't you?
Thank you.
I sometimes think of that as being kind of maximal minimalism. Do you know what I mean? Because he takes patterns, but he does so much more with them.
Absolutely. And you could, Milstein was picking them out, wasn't he? You could hear beautifully the progression, which is not programmatic in any way.
The first movement from the Partita for Unaccompanied Violin, number 3 in E major by Bach, played by Nathan Milstein. Vaughan Williams, which is perhaps slightly contrasting aesthetic.
Yes, absolutely. But as I'm always saying in my work as an editor, why should you only like one thing? I think that if you're a poet and you've been a musician, you have to come to terms with Lieder. And I'm sorry to say that when you're an instrumentalist, you tend to think that music with words is somehow applied music and instrumental music is pure. And so it's taken me some time. But one of the first pieces that I loved was On Wenlock Edge, not only because it's got a string quartet and I'm addicted to chamber music, but also because I love the Hausmann originals. They're not pastiche. They're very inflected. They take all the dignity of folk narrative or folk song. They're beautifully controlled. They're just beautifully written poems. And then I am a great admirer of Vaughan Williams. Although I'm such a passionate European, I do love the English tradition in music.
Well, it's rather wonderful that you've got Benjamin Britten and Peter Pearce in that That's... case, because after all, Britten's aesthetic actually was very much to do with words, I think.
Yes.
Unquestionably.
Yes, you can hear that. It's a very speaking music, isn't it? And I did want to have some Britten, but there wasn't time.
No, but I think that, again, from your latest collection, there's a poem that would go rather nicely as a preface to the Vaughan Williams. So before we hear Breedon Hill from On Wenlock Edge, let's hear Fiona Sampson, your poem that you've chosen for us.
Well, this is One County Down in Oxfordshire rather than, I think Breedon Hill's in Worcestershire, isn't it? It's just north of Gloucester. The legend is that if you go up Breedon Hill on Midsummer, I think you'll go mad or turn into a poet, something like that. This is the corn versicles. I love paths cut through corn, through grass and meadow sweet, that clean opening. As if the path were a pattern for life, abstract and true. As if form were a truth about you. And I love to walk the new swathes where stalks start up from the exact gold dark as I reach down to touch each corn head with a fingertip. It makes me think of Helena, Empress Mother of Constantine, gambling on the natural justice that gods reward faithfulness. Everything good still waits in the next field. The best is yet to come, and it smells of warm earth crazed by sun, of seed heads husked against my thumb. Do you remember when we walked at Eastleach? Did you see me stoop and grow strange to myself, like the rows of wheat, like shaking bells of husk?
In summertime on Breedon, the bears they saw. Oh,
Well, my pianist friends will probably kill me for saying this, but I did feel there was a composer conjuring up the sounds of bells on the piano there.
Yes, I mean, surely.
Breedon Hill from On Wenlock Edge by Vaughan Williams, sung by Peter Peers, Benjamin Britten playing the piano with the Zorian String Quartet. Actually, Britten leads us rather nicely into what I wanted to talk about next, Fiona Sampson. You wrote a very interesting lecture, which I've just been reading, called Music Lessons, which has been published. And you make some quite provocative, thoughtful comments about the nature of music and poetry in a way that only perhaps a musician poet can. But yet you do mention how, for example, in Tennyson, in the Serenade, Britten manages, if you like, to kind of put right what is not the greatest line of Tennyson.
The splendour falls on castle walls. And yes.
And how he does it, which is more interesting.
Yes.
Talk about how, just explain that.
Well, I think that when we talk about the musicality of poetry, to approach it that way round, we mean a whole freight of things. Actually, we don't quite know what we mean. We mean it sounds nice in some loose way. But it seems to me that there are actually quite structural, quite formative elements that music and poetry have in common, which are to do with abstract form, largely. And one particular thing they have in common is their secret origins, or their overt origins, in the spoken line, in the phrasal breath. Chomsky talks about generative grammar, but I even begin to think that a grammatical phrase, a subject, verb, object phrase, is pretty much what we can say in one breath. It's almost as if we think with our breath. In other words, or the breath governs what we can do at one time. And what that also means, some way down the road, is that speech rhythms sometimes fall across grammar, and they certainly often fall across strict metre. I mean, you only have to hear a poet read an enjambment, read, you know, the sense that goes across the end of the line, to know that. And Britten, in his setting, he does set in a very talky way. So that he stretches, the splendour falls on castle walls, and actually that's how we hear the line for ourselves. We don't hear the splendour falls on castle walls. We hear the give and take, the rhythmic give and take, and the give and take of pitch and emphasis, which is partly produced by the vowel and partly produced by sense.
I've been thinking a lot recently, because of having had problems with my hearing, about Beethoven's late music, and in particular the late quartets. And I suspect that some of the conclusions that I've come to are probably shared by you. I mean, in that it seems to me that Beethoven retreats to some more profound inner sense of vision as a result of perhaps being cut off from
Absolutely.
The outside world.
And when you think about words and music, one of the things you think is, what is the meaning of music as if it can be transcribed into words? You know, that's awful sort of E.M. Forster talking about goblins walking over the universe and so on. I mean, a rare lapse. And obviously the meaning of music is itself, but that doesn't mean it's not a form of human thinking, human working out and human experience. It clearly is, isn't it? One of the things I'm very aware of, in fact, I often make a joke about, is that I spent many hours a day in my formative years, when presumably my brain was still plastic, thinking without words, because you're thinking the music, aren't you? You're not going E major, A7. You're playing the music. You're thinking the music. And it undeniably is thinking. And it's not prior to language, but it's in some way analogous with, parallel.
Thank you.
course, in that quartet, Fiona Sampson, Beethoven was playing around not just with the kind of ideas that were going to lead on to future generations of composers, Liszt, Wagner, but also with ideas for his own Ninth Symphony, which he was just trying out.
Yes. I think all the late quartets, you have this strong sense of something's going to emerge. Complete integration is just about to emerge. And that's, in a sense, both what's so obviously amazing, but also quite difficult, I find, about the Ninth, about the Ode to Joy. It's so foursquare and final and definitional.
But I'm very pleased to hear you say that, because the actual Ode to Joy, I once created a bit of a storm by saying on Radio 3 that I found it unbearably repetitive and rebarbative, and I didn't want to hear that particular thing again. It was too famous and caused quite a stir. But actually, I think there is a sort of slight throwing it in your face time and time again.
Yes. I mean, I remember the first time I heard it. For some reason, I hadn't for a long time, and I was so disappointed. I thought it was going to be tremendous, like the late quartets. And I think now we're moved by it because so many people have sung it on so many meaningful occasions.
The fifth movement from the string quartet in A minor, opus 132, by Beethoven, played by the Borodin String Quartet there. Just before I allow you to go, Fiona Sampson, a quick word about your book, Beyond the Lyric, which is a sort of map of contemporary British poetry. I mean, you've been very busy to produce the poetry and this, but it's a very fascinating, your view of where certain things are going.
Well, thank you. I think that one of the things about having a formation as an instrumentalist is that you are an interpreter. You realise that it's your shortcoming if you don't get a particular kind of music. And there isn't that much thinking still like that in contemporary British poetry. The tendency for people in each school of writing to sort of treasure that as being what the poetic values are and sometimes be resistant to other ways of writing. And actually, British poetry at the moment is tremendously rich, and an awful lot of really wonderful writing is going on in very different ways. So there are sort of almost surreal, almost trickster poets like some of the women like Maeve McGuckian and Salima Hill. And then there are people who are still using the ghost, at least, of iambic pentameter and are very thoughtful and carrying that burden of authority like Sean O'Brien. And then there are sort of explosive lyricists like John Burnside. There are a lot of different writings going on.
Well, thank you very much, Fiona Sampson, for allowing me to indulge in some conversational chamber music.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Fiona Sampson was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, another chance to hear the art critic Andrew Graham Dixon talking to Michael about art and music. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall.
BBC Radio 3's World Roots, with cross-cultural musical collaborations from countries along the River Nile. Performers from Egypt, Sudan, Ethiopia and Uganda.
The musicians participating are some of the deepest musicians I know.
There's a lot of connections. Of course, the connections are not just like, you have to listen to your music, internalize it, and then the connection comes. If you really pay attention, you see a lot of connections.
Go online now to the Radio 3 website or download the BBC iPlayer radio app to catch up with the first programme and hear the second of the two tonight on BBC Radio 3 at 10 o'clock.
Hello, I'm John Shea. Welcome to this Sunday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. In a couple of minutes, the keyboard music of Frescobaldi in today's early music show with Catherine Bott. But now, with the time at 1 o'clock, here's the latest BBC news. Human rights lawyers have criticised the Home Secretary for accusing some immigration judges of ignoring new guidance designed to deport most foreign criminals. Theresa May insists that the right of criminals to retain a family life in Britain must be balanced with the need to protect the public, and she's promised legislation to increase the rate of deportation. Security sources in Nigeria say at least one Briton is among seven foreigners who've been kidnapped in the north of the country. Police say gunmen stormed the site of a construction company in the town of Jamaare. The commander of the US-led NATO forces in Afghanistan says he accepts the Afghan president's ban on Afghan security forces calling in airstrikes by NATO-led forces in residential areas. General Joseph Dunford said there were various ways to support Afghan forces other than air ordnance. A British teenager who was lost in the Australian outback for 3 days has said he was just hours away from death. Samuel Woodhead, who's 18, went missing in Queensland on Tuesday. He survived by drinking contact lens solution. The head of the Bar Council, which represents barristers in England and Wales, has said she believes that in many cases suspected rapists should have their identities protected until they're convicted. Maura McGowan says the stigma attached to sex crimes means that reputations can be damaged even if the allegations are proved false. Pope Benedict has appeared at the window of his study overlooking St Peter's Square at the Vatican, one of his last public appearances before stepping down as head of the Roman Catholic Church at the end of the month. The Pope thanked the crowd gathered below for the support they had given him in the last few days and asked them to continue praying for him and for his successor. Cricket. England have lost the opening one-day international to New Zealand by 3 wickets in Hamilton. Having bowled England out for 258, New Zealand reached their victory target of 259 with 7 balls to spare. And the weather. Most areas will have a dry day with sunny periods. However, southeastern parts will become cloudier and western Scotland may be fairly cloudy throughout. Top temperatures will be between 5 and 8 degrees Celsius. And that's the news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at almost 3 minutes past one. So in just under an hour from now, we're off to Leeds Town Hall for a concert recorded last week, our Sunday concert given by the BBC Philharmonic, Beethoven's Violin Concerto, Webern's Passacaglia and Brahms' Fourth Symphony. That's at 2 o'clock. Before that, time for today's early music show. Catherine Bott focuses on music by a pioneering 17th century master of the keyboard.
Girolamo Frescobaldi, born in Ferrara in 1583, has been called the father of the keyboard. He was lucky enough to be the son of an organist, the godson of a composer, Luzzasco Luzzaschi, and to grow up in a musical hothouse. Ferrara was ruled by Duke Alfonso d'Este, an obsessive music lover and lavish patron. Taught by his godfather, the boy Girolamo was a keyboard prodigy, exposed to all the best in music and instruments. Visiting composers included Dowland, Marenzio, Monteverdi and Gesualdo. At the age of 25, he began a stellar career as an organist in Rome, where he would live and work for much of the rest of his life. He taught Froberger and Pachelbel and influenced the work of John Blow and later J.S. Bach. Although he didn't always handle his personal affairs very efficiently, his playing won him a considerable following. Someone once said of him that all his knowledge is at the end of his fingertips. Thank you. the Toccata Seconda from Frescobaldi's second book of toccatas and partitas, played by Fabio Bonizzoni on a newly released recording of books 1 and 2. Fabio founded the acclaimed ensemble La Risonanza in 1995, and he says that whether playing or conducting, the point is always to get the music the way you like it. The reward is always to get in reality what you have in your imagination. Well, a great deal of imagination and insight has gone into this compelling recording. The BBC Music magazine calls it a benchmark disc, fusing intellectual rigour with soulful expression. And to discuss this arresting and involving repertoire, I'm delighted to welcome Fabio Bonizzoni himself, down the line from the Netherlands. Welcome, Fabio. How nice of you to join me.
Thank you. Hello.
Staying with that outstanding review for a moment, it begins with quite a provocative statement, really. It was Girolamo Frescobaldi who unleashed the keyboard's potential to turn human passion into purely instrumental sound. What is it that sets Frescobaldi apart from his contemporaries, do you think?
I think it's very true, the sentence. I think he was the first one who got a mature language for expressing the movement of the soul through the keyboard. And I mean, it's like if we don't have to guess which are the sentiment painted, but actually we just see it, it's just evident.
We have to set his output against a background in which really most early music is vocal, isn't it, over a few centuries. Was he, as I've read, the first composer to specialise in instrumental music?
No, he was not the first, I think, but he was definitely the most successful. And I mean, his achievement in instrumental music, particularly on keyboard music, are just the most important of his whole career. I mean, if you take Monteverdi, of course, he was a genius for voices, and he was just a genius for the keyboard. In this sense, I understand people saying that his knowledge was at the tip of his fingers, because, I mean, it's just through the tip of his fingers that he could create these incredible masterpieces, these never-ending stories, in a way.